And
24.
There are no amendments, and I think Senator Shoemaker has gotten his question answered, remember?
What, I don't even, no.
You had a question about 24, 29.
Okay, let's take a look.
Thank you, to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please, Pat.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Rinsky? Hill? Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye, motion carried. Thank you. I don't think I have any time, this is work session anyway. Oh, actually, we don't have.
No amendments.
No amendments. Representative Peterson is not here, we'll try to send for her. Representative Bunn had comments on 3094, so we might send a note to Representative Bunn's staff, who had testimony last time, if I recall. Are there folks here on 27, do we have sign-up sheets? 2769 relating to assigned contracts?
I think we do.
Can't table that, no. That Bronner's bill, another one of Bronner's bills.
Is it?
No, I don't know. Yeah, Oregon Bankers.
Frank, there's, Frank is here. 2769, public hearing and possible work session. Sorry, we have a number of legislators scattered around the building who want to be heard on some of these bills. It's really hard to sort of track everybody down at the right time. Frank, 2769.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association, State Chartered Banks of Oregon. RS 20097 provides that a person who assigns a contract may be liable for attorney fees if the person to whom the contract is assigned later sues on the contract and loses. This is as it should be if the contract did not represent a valid claim at the time of the assignment. A recent court case in eastern Oregon, however, has interpreted 20097 as providing that the person who assigns a contract will be liable for attorney fees even if the contract represented a valid claim at the time of the assignment. In the case of Theo versus the United States National Bank, and the case is cited for you, the court held that the assigner was liable for attorney fees even though it was the action of the assignee which rendered the contract invalid. House Bill 2769 is intended to clarify that the liability of the assigner for attorney fees shall exist only if the claim evidenced by the assigned contract was defective at the time of the assignment. Madam Chair, members, we urge the passage of 2769. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Hey, Senator Springer?
Frank, do I understand that this was just some district or circuit court decision that hasn't been appealed, or may be appealed, or?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, the bank involved decided not to appeal. They were surprised. What literally happened is that they had the parents, dairy farmers in eastern Oregon. The parents were co-signed on a note with son and daughter-in-law. There were two divorces involved and two bankruptcies involved. The co-signers paid off the loan, and thus the bank assigned the loan to the parents. The parents proceeded against property of the daughter-in-law. Years passed.
Family farming dispute, huh?
And frankly, the daughter-in-law prevailed, and not only that, then brought suit against the bank I think, 2 years afterwards for attorney fees and was successful. We don't think we're trying to change what was the intent of the law. We think we're trying to clarify. If you'd like, I can get you a copy of the case, Senator Springer. It's a rather interesting case, and I think it's probably would never happen again, but since it happened, we'd like to clarify.
I would be curious in reading the case. Thank you.
Senator Schumaker.
You need a chart to figure out who's who in reading the case, yes.
I have one question, Frank. I noticed that the responsibility for attorney's fees turns on whether the defense that was asserted existed at the time of the assignment of the contract. And it seems to me that a more relevant date is whether it existed at the time of the commencement of the suit.
Well, in the, Madam Chair, Senator Schumaker, in the case, at the time of the transfer or the assignment, it was clearly indicated that the bank had been, their obligation, the obligation had been satisfied insofar as the bank was concerned, and they were assigning the contract. The suit was not commenced for, I believe, a year or so afterwards.
Mm-hmm. That,
the bank believed when they assigned the contract, inasmuch as they had been satisfied completely, that they were completely absolved of any further action, and the action was then between the borrower and the cosigners, in this case, the parents.
Mm-hmm. Let me see. So in that suit, it wouldn't be fair to make the bank liable.
That always be true, though? That always, is the amendment that you propose always be fair? I guess I don't know enough about the law to track it through and see what the permutations are, but I mean, you could imagine a situation where...
Madam Chair, Senator Schumaker, if you don't know enough about the law, I certainly am not going to be able to respond.
I'm not familiar with the law.
We believe that what we're suggesting in this bill has always been the law. We believe that when an assignment is made, when the obligation has been satisfied, that person is completely out of the transaction. The transaction then is between the parties still involved. We think it would always be fair.
Mr. Springer?
Well, let me, I don't, that's why I think maybe reading the case might be helpful.
Be happy to provide the case.
I don't have any hands-on experience in this area. But let me ask, on the House side, or is this the first time this has been up for hearing here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who else we've got. Has anybody from the State Bar, the business section, or the creditor-debtor section had a chance to review this to your knowledge or make any comments?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, nobody appeared in opposition on the House side, and we did provide, and were requested to, and I intended to have it with me, a copy of the case for each member to review, and I'd be happy to do that. I'm sorry that I didn't do that today.
The other question, if I may, is I don't think I've seen a section quite like Section 2 before, where you say that this amendment does not constitute a change in but is declaratory of existing law and shall apply to all contracts on before ever existed, may ever exist?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Springer, I'm told by legislative counsel there are other, that it is not precedent.
Wouldn't be the first time.
It would not be the first time.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I guess it's all right.
Well, we can hold this over to people get a chance to look at the date, look at the cases as long as you've got it, and we'll bring it up on probably Friday.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Bunn is here on House Bill 3094. Is that correct? Representative, we're not sure which bills are aren't belong to whom these days, but they just keep coming. 3094, folks. This has to do with ethics, if I recall correctly.
Madam Chair and members of the House, for your record, my name is Stan Bunn, and I represent District 29 in the House, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3094. And I'd like to give you a bit of the perspective that I come from as I introduced and support this bill. I had the opportunity to serve as a member of and chairman of the Ethics Commission. And during that period of time, the primary complaints dealt with members of small city councils or planning commissions or those sorts of groups. And the complaint often came in a hand-scribbled letter to the Ethics Commission complaining about the conduct of the public official, and very broad in its terms, and indicated that there should be an investigation. And I remember particularly the frustration I felt in reviewing both valid complaints that were very clear in the nature of the complaint and, in fact, findings that the public official had carried out misconduct, but a large number of cases that, in my mind, ultimately ended in a finding of no wrongdoing, in which a public official that had served in a city council for 15 or 20 years would say to the commission, I just want you to know I'll never serve in a public office again because it's simply not worth it to go through this kind of process. And my sense was that there were a number of cases where, if you will, it was sort of a witch hunt by a disgruntled citizen. And I think that to the degree we can diminish or minimize that kind of thing, it's beneficial. And the bill very simply does four things. It says, first, that when there is a complaint, the Ethics Commission will notify the party complained about before they make public disclosure or give that information to the press. Two, that there will be a finding of probable cause before they go on with the hearing. Three, that there will be specified in writing exactly what the complaint is. And finally, that if there is an investigation, that investigation will report both the good information obtained and the bad information obtained. And the bill was designed to try to protect the need for open and public process, but at the same time say, we want to simply give a procedural protection to the accused person. There has been a suggestion that since the time I served on the commission, some of these problems have been taken care of, or if they haven't been taken care of, they can be taken care of by rule. The comments I've gotten from people who have experienced that process of the Ethics Commission since my service there indicates that there are still problems, and it's my feeling that the protections we feel are reasonable should be built into the statute. I would make one comment. On line 10 of the bill, it requires notification of the public official. I had suggested to the committee in the House that we provide for good faith attempts to notify. The House committee wanted to be a little more stringent on the matter than I did and left it as it was. But I would again say that I have no objection to requiring a good faith attempt to notify so that if there's a problem with actual notification, it doesn't stall the process. With that, I would strongly urge your adoption of the bill, and I would be glad to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thanks, Representative Bunn. Are there questions?
When would be the circumstance that you couldn't notify a public official? They're supposed to be very hard to find.
Well, my concern is that if you have I certainly don't want to say obscure, but if you have a member of a commission or some small body that is on not in the area at the time and the press is beating at the door of the Ethics Commission, I wasn't sure that we should say that the Ethics Commission has to wait for a long period of time. And frankly, my suggestion for the change came because I think Betty Reynolds had expressed a concern about
she
that
will,
provision.
She signed up to testify, and okay. We'll hear from her.
And I just wanted to signal this committee Great. That I'm flexible on that issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you. The other questions? Comments? Thanks. See you a little bit later. Betty?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Betty Reynolds. I'm Director of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. Bob Ingalls, his vice chair, would be here today. He's a former legislator, but he was unavailable. The commission has reviewed the bill and believes that its existing procedures provide the safeguards that are proposed and might even exceed due process requirements. For example, prior to conducting an investigation, the commission provides the respondent a copy of the complaint with a notice and an explanation of the commission's procedures and a copy of the statutes. Prior to any hearing or meeting on a complaint, the commission provides a copy of its findings and another explanation of the procedures, and it's a very open process where all parties are invited to comment. I think the objectivity of the commission's investigations and proceedings is attested to by the fact that the commission actions are rarely appealed, and in the 15 years of the commission's existence, none of its actions have been overturned. The commission, after 15 years, finally has a full-time investigator. That person is an attorney, and he does review all complaints with professional objectivity and fairness. Finally, the bill as drafted, the commission is concerned that it has potential for causing delay. That is, the commission is a citizen commission created by the electorate. It meets approximately every 4 to 6 weeks. If the commission were required to, for example, find probable cause prior to initiating an investigation, or were required to deliberate before expanding the scope of an investigation.
Excuse me, but don't you do that as a staff person before you bring it to the commission?
Madam Chair.
Isn't that possible for you to have a rule authorizing you to bring notice to people to say there's been a request being filed, an investigation will be undertaken? And I don't understand why that's a problem.
Madam Chair,
you do all sorts of investigation, hasn't it?
Madam Chair, the commission's existing administrative rules provide that the commission, the only basis for determining not to conduct an investigation is to determine there's no probable cause. It's a double negative, but in essence, the staff reviews a complaint, decides whether there's jurisdiction and sufficient specificity so that we can proceed and bring the preliminary findings to the commission with a probable cause recommendation. We're pleased that with the full-time compliance manager, we have been able to exceed the legislatively approved turnaround time of 150 days. It's even less than that. And the commission's concern is that the bill as drafted may cause delay. But Senator Cohen, you are correct. The staff does make that determination at this point.
Further comments?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Brenneman.
When did that particular routine go into effect?
Madam Chair, Senator Brenneman, it's an administrative rule. I've been director since 1979, and it was an existing administrative rule at that time. So I'm sorry I can't provide the exact date, but it's been at least 10 years.
Well, I was pretty close to one of the investigation of a friend of mine that didn't quite go. Since 79, it didn't quite go on that exact frame.
Senator Hill.
Thank you. Betty, I wanted to ask you about the scope of the investigations. It seems as though what tends to happen is that sort of starts out investigating one thing, and then it's kind of one thing that leads to another, and then you end up going through sometimes going through somebody's entire life and looking for everything. Now, what about, do you notify someone when the scope of the investigation is going to broaden?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the respondent is provided with a copy of the complaint letter and is provided with notice. The complaints are often generally stated, alleging violation of, for example, the Code of Ethics, use of office for personal gain. Ordinarily, the investigation would be conducted sufficient to gather evidence to assist the commission in determining whether there's cause to believe a violation may have occurred. if other allegations within the commission's jurisdiction come to light, they may be included, but it's ordinarily confined to the matters alleged.
I'm sure my, with respect to investigations that are going on and how public those investigations become, what are you required to, what does the press have access to when you have an ongoing investigation?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, I'm glad you asked that question. I think the commission, some of the concerns about the commission's proceedings have to do with the fact that it's all of its records are specifically designated public records, both in Chapter 171, the lobby regulation laws, Chapter 244, government ethics laws, and their public records pursuant to Chapter 192. If we do claim any confidentiality exceptions, they're only those that are authorized under Chapter 192. So the answer is our records are specifically designated public records, and the files are open files.
Including your records of your investigators as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, yes. As you know, Chapter 192 does provide certain exceptions to investigations. The Ethics Commission is not one of those agencies exempted.
Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
I know it's a real delicate line, but what seems to happen is that, for example, when someone is investigating, they will get someone's statements that may or may not be factual. The investigator just goes around and asks people what they think. And see, they're really, for public officials, there's two things going on. Number one is it's a very, very much of a legal process determining whether someone is guilty or innocent. But we also are very susceptible to what happens in the press. And there's so much that can be made of what happens that by the time it's all done, it doesn't matter whether you've been found guilty or innocent because you've already been splattered across the press. And been splattered across the press, and usually by the time you're found innocent, and maybe this is a matter with the press, they always put that in somewhere in the back page that nothing came of it. Do you have any way or any plan to try to address that kind of situation?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the commission administers the laws under its jurisdiction. Exempting the commission's records from the public meetings law, the public records law, is not part of our package, but I would respectfully suggest that would be a way to remedy the problem. I did bring the commission.
Can I interrupt a minute? The open records law does still require a request for disclosure. 192 still says you have to go and ask, and you can turn them down for purposes of confidentiality for a week or whatever until you finalize whatever you're doing. I mean, I think there can be good reasons for you to not to disclose at a particular time particular information that's being asked for. So it's not as if somebody can walk into your office and demand. I mean, you can refuse under some grounds and in some circumstances. Do you refuse, and I just want people to be clear on what 192 does.
Yes, Madam Chair, we have refused and have gone through the process where the Department of Justice makes a determination regarding the confidentiality.
Okay. Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else who signed up to speak on House Bill 3094? Eric Carlson.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Eric Carlson with the League of Oregon Cities. We have a record, we have a letter that's been placed in your file on this. We support 3094 as is. It is our feeling that 3094 sets out appropriate broad standards for the commission to do its work. Its process is as important as the substance of the work it does. We think those standards that are set forth belong in statute after public debate in this kind of a forum. I should tell you that in connection with another bill, I went to look at the Ethics Commission's rules, with the exception of a couple of minor changes. They have not been changed since 1980, and this is in the face of a bill that was passed in the 1987 session that made a significant number of changes in the ethics law. So I'm not, the Ethics Commission is not on top of its own rules process, and I think it's appropriate that these kind of standards get set in the statute to guide them in their own internal processes. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, Eric.
Madam Chair, I'll make a motion to send 394 to the floor with a due pass. 3094.
Senator Brenneman has moved House Bill 3094 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as a discussion. Oh, that's not what his motion is. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Rockman?
Aye.
Grinsky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Shoemaker?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much, Senator Brenneman. Carry this. Okay, let's move to, is Nancy Peterson here? She's probably down in Ways and Means with all the crisis going on. Yes, helping. Let's take up 3068, and then we'll get Jack in to do work session and go on down the list. 3068 is a bill that comes to us from Senator Hill's committee. It's here for discussion of the triple damages, I think. Not as to... Right. Ruth Ann Mogan, Barry Amson, the Oregon PUD Association, whoever you want to bring up, Sandra Bishop, Bob Hall. I want to thank you for waiting around a second day. Appreciate your being willing to understand.
Thank you. Ms. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandra Bishop. I'm here representing the Oregon People's Utility District Association. And I have with me today Ruth Ann Mogan, who is our executive director for the PUD Association, and also Barry Adamson, who is an attorney here representing the PUD Association, to answer any questions. So Ms. Mogan is going to go ahead and start testimony, and I'll pass out that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ruth Ann Mogan, and I'm executive director of the Oregon PUD Association. We represent all six of the PUDs in the state of Oregon. Current Oregon statute does not provide an adequate deterrent to reduce the theft of utility service. The result is that honest utility customers pay for the power that is stolen, and utility employee safety is put at risk. In today's scenario, the following happens. We discover that a customer has willfully tampered with an electric meter. We then ask the district attorney to prosecute for a criminal penalty under ORS 164.125. The utility must then prove the actual loss. The best method is to place a check meter ahead of the suspect's meter. After about 1 week, we have enough information to estimate the difference between actual use and recorded use. Although our records may indicate that the meter had been recording inaccurately for a long time, there is no way to prove it. Other factors besides meter tampering could indicate a dramatic change in power usage, so we cannot prove that there's the extent of the theft of service. The Emerald PUD in Lane County has 75 to 80 known theft of service incidences each year. To put that number into perspective, Emerald PUD serves approximately 13,700 total customers. They were recently alerted to a possible theft of power, with the power being diverted from a residence to a nearby barn. They placed a check meter on the residence for 13 days. The check meter indicated usage of 282.47 kilowatt hours per day. The records from the residence meter indicated usage of 58.47 kilowatt hours a day. That's approximately 230-some kilowatt hours difference. The cost of the unmetered usage of electricity was $8,531.15. Through the court system, Emerald was allowed to collect $1,508, the amount substantiated by the check meter. The dollars that customer saved on electricity certainly added to the profitability of his marijuana crop. I have attached a more detailed description of the case that is attached to my testimony. National surveys indicate the estimated annual cost of electricity theft from the nation's utilities anywhere from $1.7 to $4 billion. On a national average, each of the 100 million consumers in the United States pays from $17 to $40 annually to offset losses due to theft by less than 1% of the utility's customers. Several of Oregon's PUDs are in the process of updating and modernizing all customer metering within their systems. The risk to utility employees working with tampered meters is great. We want to further protect those employees by making abusers aware of both the criminal and civil consequences if they tamper with their meter to divert electricity. House Bill 3068 allows for treble damages for the theft of utility service. It puts potential violators on notice that we will protect the majority of our customers, the honest ones, as well as the safety of our employees from the abuser who steals electricity. Along with my testimony, I have provided a summary of the bill's